Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. During the course of her 20-year career as a foreign journalist, Clarissa Ward survived the car bombing of her hotel in Baghdad during the Sunni uprising, Israeli shelling in the Gaza Strip, an angry mob of Han Chinese during the Uyghur protests in Xinjiang province in China, an arduous border crossing with Rohingya refugees from Myanmar to Bangladesh while being pregnant, even fighting off the unwelcome advances of Muammar Gaddafi's son in the backseat of a town car in Moscow. But the story that has stayed with her most is the tragic story of Syria, which she reported on extensively, and the horrors of the siege of Aleppo. Ward addressed the UN Security Council on what she witnessed there in 2016. She tells those stories and much more in her memoir, On All Fronts, The Education of a Journalist. Clarissa Ward started her career as a producer for the news division of Fox News. She later became a correspondent for the network, later moved to ABC News, then CBS, and finally CNN, where she is now the network's chief international correspondent. Her work has been awarded a Peabody Award, two Emmys, and the Murrow Award for International Reporting. She's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Clarissa Ward, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on, Rich.
On All Fronts is a really interesting, fascinating memoir of the first half of your life as a foreign correspondent and your decision to go into journalism and the first half of your career. I'm always interested in the decision to reflect on one's life and work and write about it, especially for you. It's probably about the midpoint of life and career. What led you to write On All Fronts?
I really felt that I wanted to write a book when I became pregnant with my first son. And I knew that there would be all these things I would want to share with him and tell him about that sort of define who I am as a person outside of the prism of just being his mom. And then what happened, I started to write it as a letter to him, and my agent pointed out that there was a lot of cursing and death in the book and that it seemed a little odd to write a letter to a baby about such sort of adult subject matter. So I reframed it slightly. But then as I was writing it, I realized, of course, I very much hope that my sons will read it and enjoy it and learn to understand me in a different way as a result of it. But really, it's a love letter to journalism and to this craft and to the work that we do. And it's a thank you letter to all the people I have met along the way, whose lives I've had the privilege of crossing paths with, who have been so generous with me, not just professionally, but out in the field in these different conflicts. Because those are the moments that really shape your understanding of a people or a place, but they don't make it onto the evening news. And so I wanted to have an outlet for that.
That was one of the most interesting things I think I found about the book, is the fact that the people a journalist will use, and I say use in the fact of helping them get the story out, becomes the way you help, you understand a culture oftentimes. Your drivers, the people that help you negotiate how to get from one place to another place, usually in a war zone. The translators, if you need them, you speak five languages, so many times you're conversing yourself, but these people help you understand a culture. How important is that to understanding the place you're reporting from?
Oh, it's essential. You know, it's the big cliche of the sort of grand reporter who sweeps in and the first three quotes in his article are all from the taxi driver on the ride from the airport. But actually, that's how you learn about a people or a place, is by just chatting to people, just talking to them. It's why I love this job so much. It's sitting down and having conversations and hearing different perspectives. And, you know, people always say, oh, it's such a depressing job, though, and you're in these depressing places. But actually, you see the worst of humanity. You also see the best of humanity. And there are these countless acts of kindness and moments of connection and laughter and joy, even in the most unlikely of places. And those often are the moments that really tell the bigger story about a people or a place. And so it's essential to have that knowledge and to have that feeling of connection on a certain level with a different culture that enables you to really feel compassion and empathy and a more sophisticated level of understanding of what it is that they're going through.
You know, in a way, it makes me very jealous of what you do, because As you well know, it is so difficult to get international news into mainstream American journalism. Mm. And, you know, once upon a time, it seems like I can remember a day when there was time for news that helped you understand these cultures better. And now it is all about conflict, natural disasters, very momentous events. Those are the only things that break through our own news barrier here in the United States.
You know, look, it's changed a lot. I came of age as a journalist in the post-9/11 era, and there was a huge appetite for international stories, and there was a huge appetite from many Americans to understand how that could have happened and why it happened and would it happen again and what could be done to stop it from happening again. And obviously the U.S. was engaged in wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and so it was a different moment in time, and people were looking outward. I think now, understandably, many Americans are looking inward. There's so many problems at home in the U.S. There's a lot of domestic turmoil that preoccupies people. And so it makes sense that the focus has shifted inwards. But I do, of course, very much hope that there will come a time when, you know, people will be looking outwards again. Because at the end of the day, by virtue of our economic interconnectedness and the way social media has transformed the world, we live in a smaller world than ever before. We are more interconnected than ever before. And the rest of the world is always looking very closely at America. And sometimes I think it's good for America to also be looking closely at the rest of the world and at its impact on the rest of the world.
Well, as you well know, today American news is being dominated by three major stories. In the immediate now, it's the election, but perhaps the larger story has been the norm-breaking nature of the present presidential administration. Mm-hmm. The second story, the global pandemic, and perhaps that's number one at this particular point. And the third is the racial reckoning taking place in the United States. And this has seemed to snuff out virtually every other story, even natural disasters that would have been the number one story for weeks, such as the fires in the West or the epic number of hurricanes we've had. These are, you know, a blip on the news media
but
right now.
But you look at those three stories. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. But you look at those three stories you mentioned, and they're like huge, huge stories. I mean, this is like seismic stuff. I mean, I think a lot of Americans feel that the earth is moving beneath their feet. And I often get the question from people, what are some of the coping tools that you've acquired over the years working in conflict zones to help you stay grounded when it does feel like the ground is moving beneath you? And I think so many Americans right now are consumed by anxiety about the pandemic, about what's going on in their own country. And, you know, in any normal situation, frankly, COVID alone is enough to completely change the way we live, to change the way we work, to change the way we communicate, to change the way we interact with each other. It's extraordinary, the ramifications of this global pandemic. It's the likes of which, if you had described it in a Hollywood movie a year ago, we all would have said it was over the top and it wasn't believable. And yet here we are living through it. So I do think it makes sense that the news agenda is very much focused on those three big stories. But yes, of course, when I look at the wildfires in the West, as you mentioned, and, you know, the protest movement in Belarus and other stories out there that aren't getting the attention that they would have in a different news cycle, of course, I feel a little bit sad that it's just not really possible for people to be aware of every single story in one moment where there's so much happening.
And that's the gist of my question. It's just, what are Americans missing about what's happening in the world now? Of course, every country in the world is dealing with COVID, but what are they missing and what should they be knowing about what's happening now?
Well, I think that they should be aware of the fact that the situation with China is rapidly getting to a very bad place, whereby, you know, a few wrong footings could mean that you're looking at some sort of a cold war between the U.S. and China, which frankly neither side stands to benefit from at all. So it's sort of a dangerous, intense inflection point, and I do think that China will continue to be a very big and important story even if it's not consuming people's attention in the way that some of these other stories that we just talked about are. I think another thing that would have got more attention in a different era are the protesters in Belarus. It's led largely by women. The leader of Belarus, which is a small country on Russia's doorstep, is the last dictator in Europe. He is supported by the Kremlin and by President Putin. But he's facing some pretty stiff protests, the likes of which he hasn't seen before. And these protesters, in turn, are being cracked down on in brutal fashion. And so in another era, I think that that story would be getting a lot more attention.
And it was over a disputed election in which he claimed, I think, or the official results were he won 80-something percent of the vote. And the people begged to differ.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, it's sort of depressing to think that in this day and age you can still have that kind of electoral rigging going on in a country that really is in Europe, although not in the European Union, but on Europe's doorstep, certainly. But here we are, and all these years later, he is still in power, and he seems to be able to fend off these protests even, because he does have the support of the Russian government behind him.
Yeah. You mentioned China, and you worked in China for a while, and I was really struck by something, not necessarily about your reporting, but what you observed about the people you were working with in China. You said they all face this sort of internal pressure that seems to be within them at all times, and it would sort of rear its head at strange moments. And it just sort of struck me as, you know, we're going through COVID. We're kind of experiencing that too, you know, in the United States.
I think the United States is absolutely going through a moment of profound anxiety and intense pressure. COVID is obviously a huge part of it, and homeschooling, which is so challenging for so many different families, and the financial pressures that COVID has brought with it. It's a slightly different kind of pressure than the one you see in China, because the pressure that you saw in China was, a lot of it was self-inflicted, almost. It was this incredible drive to improve your social standing, to improve your financial situation, to drag your family basically out of poverty, and there were huge opportunities to do that, but it entailed working harder than most of us could even conceive of, than most people would argue is probably even healthy. And huge amounts of pressures in the schooling system and on children to learn, usually by rote. And then you don't have a lot of outlets in China for that pressure, right? Because you don't have political freedom. You don't really have freedom of expression. And so where do you internalize? Where does it all go? Much of it is internalized, and that's never healthy for any society. And you can always feel that kind of bubbling beneath the surface. One of the good things about the U.S. is that you can go and say anything you want. And so if you need to go and shout on a rooftop for a few hours about your rage with whoever it might be, you can do that. And I think that is a privilege that we sometimes forget that we are very lucky to enjoy in the United States.
My guest today is Clarissa Ward. She is the CNN's chief international correspondent and the author of a new memoir, On All Fronts, The Education of a Journalist. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. She has covered conflicts from Iraq, the Israeli conflicts in Gaza and Lebanon, Syria. She covered Aleppo, the horrors of the Syrian conflict, and many other conflicts to boot. And she is our guest, and she's written about them in All Fronts. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You earlier referred to 9/11, and you said it was an event that changed the course of your life. It was also an event that changed your particular generation's lives. I mean, so many people changed their lives' directions from 9/11. For you, it was journalism. Why journalism?
I think that, you know, as I watched what was happening unfold on television, I felt this profound sense of shame that I hadn't been more engaged with the world, because I'd always loved languages and traveling, and I'd been very privileged to live in the U.S. and the U.K. as a kid, and my father moved to Hong Kong when I was 14, so I had seen a lot of the world. But it was clear to me in that moment that I hadn't been really paying close enough attention to what was going on and to some of the more troubling dynamics that were at play. And I wanted to be more engaged. I wanted to be more knowledgeable, and I wanted to get to the root of it. I wanted to travel to the farthest flung corners of the earth and find out how this had happened and try to see how the world sees us, basically, because I think often as Americans it's easy to forget that the way we see ourselves is not always the way that the world sees or understands us. And so I really wanted to go on that journey and make those discoveries and tell those stories. And journalism was the only way I really knew or understood how to do that. So that's what I did. From that moment, I became a complete TV news junkie, as well as a consumer of all sorts of news and newspapers, and I never really turned back.
You speak a number of languages, and it seems like you take great pains whenever you're going somewhere to make sure and learn the language. I assume some journalists do, some journalists don't to a degree. How important is that to be able to converse with somebody in their language to understand what you're reporting?
Well, I mean, first of all, I would say my languages are at various levels, right? So I speak French and Italian well. My Russian and Arabic is conversational. But it's enough to get around and shoot the breeze with someone and do a basic interview and have a nice conversation. And there's no question that people let their guard down a bit when you've made the effort to learn their language. It does open doors. It does make people feel more comfortable. And it does show a certain level of respect for their culture as well, because you learn a lot about a culture through learning the language. That said, I know lots of brilliant journalists who don't speak languages. It's not a game changer. It's not essential. There are different ways of doing the job and different tools that you can use to excel in the job. For me, languages has been hugely important, and I happen to love languages as well. I wasn't planning on learning Mandarin, but when I arrived in China, I realized that you really couldn't do anything without speaking basic Mandarin. And what an incredible language it is. And so I have, I studied it and learned the basics, at least, just so that I could get around and have a basic conversation and order a drink or, you know, whatever it might be, the small things that you need to do to get around in everyday life.
You've always been a hard charger. Starting out in Iraq, you survived the bombing of the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad. You were in the hotel when it was bombed by a couple of car bombers. Covered conflicts in Gaza and Lebanon as airstrikes are going by, as I think it was Israeli aircraft were doing daily sonic booms on the residents just to keep them on edge. But it sounds like the Syrian conflict is one that has perhaps stayed with you the most. Certainly, Aleppo was a hideous situation. Can you talk a little bit about Syria and what that story has meant to you?
You know, I think there's always one conflict that you cover as a journalist that will sort of rip out your heart and won't let go. And for me, that was definitely Syria for a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, I'd never seen anything like it in terms of the David and Goliath element, whereby you had this uprising, firstly, of peaceful protesters, and then an armed uprising. But still, you were talking about carpenters and school teachers fighting with AK-47s, and they didn't even have two-way radios, and they're fighting a huge, sophisticated army that has an air force and the full backing of its Russian and Iranian sponsors. And also, I had never really covered a conflict where you saw civilians targeted in that manner, where you saw people tortured, imprisoned, disappeared, kidnapped, hospitals bombed, schools bombed, nerve agents used, chemical weapons used. It was like nothing was off limits. No line was too far. There was just no impunity, no sense of common decency. And conflicts are always hard, and civilians always get killed. But I have never seen civilians as ruthlessly targeted and persecuted as I did in Syria. And I've never covered a conflict where every single trip I did, I would come back and might be a few weeks later, it might be a few months later, I would get the call from someone I had spent time with there. Did you know that such and such a person died? They were killed in shelling. Or did you know that such and such a person starved to death? They were in a part of the country that was under siege. Or this person was tortured, and this person disappeared, and this person was arrested, and this person was executed. I mean, honestly, it was so painful to witness and experience at such an intimate level that degree of persecution and of suffering and of trauma and of murder. I really had never and have never seen anything else and quite like it.
You know, and it seems like Syria is, I suppose every conflict has this to a degree, but it seems like Syria is this to an exponential degree. You have the government and the army, you have this uprising that sort of uprose in response to what began as just a few acts of grabbing kids that protest, traumatizing them and holding them in prisons, a little bit bigger uprising, and then it just blew up. You had that uprising. Then you had Islamists come in who wanted, you know, had another reason for joining in. And you had all these different forces. You know, you had Russia, you have Turkey, you have the United States, you have Israel, all with their own unique viewpoint on this conflict and helping various groups and hindering others. It just seems like utter chaos.
It is chaos, and it is really complex. And, you know, part of the reason that I wrote the book as well is that I want people, because I think a lot of people, and especially in the U.S., they hear, oh my gosh, about Syria. And of course, they, you know, they're heartbroken to hear that people are suffering, but they're so overwhelmed by all the different players and the constant moving of the front lines and the different names of the groups that are fighting, and it's overwhelming. And what I've tried to do in this book is to say, listen, you don't have to know anything about Syria to connect with this story. This is about human beings. This is about people, good people, and I'm there kind of holding your hand and taking you on the journey with me as I experienced it. And so the chaos is a part of it, but it's not the only part of it. It's not going to overwhelm the reader, I hope. I hope they'll find that there are moments of levity as well. There are moments of just profound human connection with a story that otherwise might be too abstract and too far away for people to feel connected to.
I have to ask, there are a number of incidents where you talk about sexism in your work, whether it was working as a stand-in for Uma Thurman on Kill Bill and Quentin Tarantino choking you on the set from producers at Fox telling you to wear your hair down as in your stand-ups in a war zone, to the Taliban asking why CNN didn't send a man to speak with them. How have you responded to that in your work?
I mean, listen, I think that for the purposes of my work, my ethos has always been to kind of just tune it out and get on with it. I try not to get too distracted by it. I think when you're younger and you're starting out and you're feeling a bit more vulnerable and insecure, it is a little hard, especially when it's comments on your personal appearance. Now at this stage in my career, I know that whatever it is that makes you a bit different, for me, starting out, if you can believe it, it was because I like to wear my hair up and, you know, my accent was a bit funny because I had lived in the UK as well. But whatever it is that makes you different, that's probably your superpower. So when people tell you to change it and to become the same as everyone else, don't listen to them. Stick with what you've got going on and what you feel is natural and feel is about you. Don't take any, how shall I say this delicately, don't take any crap. Excuse me, I really paused for thought there and I couldn't come up with a better alternative. But at the same time, take it with humor. Don't take everything too seriously either. This is the advice that I give journalists. You are going to be in uncomfortable positions doing this work and traveling in the world. And you are going to experience misogyny, and you are going to be dismissed sometimes. And it can be really galling. But you're there to do a story. You're there to do your work. And that needs to be your priority. And if you need to use humor to deflect a situation, use humor. If you need to use grace or a smile, use grace or a smile, because at the end of the day, you can either sit there and have that fight with whoever it is you're with, or you can get your job done. And for me personally, for example, with the Taliban, I just, in the end, I rolled with it. I said, okay, we're going to make it part of the story. You don't want to stand on the street with me. Fine, I'll walk behind you. Is it humiliating? A little bit, but you're going to be the one who comes out looking bad when the story comes out, not me.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I'm not going to fight you on it because, frankly, it's not a fight I'm going to win, and I'm your guest. I'm in your territory, and I want to get my story, and I want to get it out there. So let's just go with the flow and tell the story. You have to be a little bit willing to roll with the punches sometimes.
In your book, you recount the fact that you lived for some time in the U.S., you lived in the U.K., and you lived in Hong Kong, and you talked about growing up with not really feeling belonging to any culture. Today, you make your home in London, and you're observing U.S. culture from afar. What can you tell us from that viewpoint about what you're seeing of U.S. life today?
So I think the thing I see that really alarms me in the U.S. today is that nobody wants to listen anymore. Nobody wants to listen to the other because listening to the other is somehow perceived of being a weakness. Listening to the other is perceived as condoning the other's ideology or views. And for me personally, I think there's great strength in listening. And I think that great things come out of listening, even if you're listening to someone who you fundamentally disagree with. And the other thing I would say, you know, in conjunction with this, it's easy to forget in this kind of very divided emotional political time that from the outside looking in, there is still much more that binds Americans together than that which divides them. And I hope that Americans will remember that because I am a little concerned when I see some of the language and the rhetoric and the dehumanization and the miscommunication and the lack of listening, as I just mentioned. I've seen that happen before in other societies, in other cultures, and I don't want the next war that I cover to be at home in the U.S. And I'm not saying we're at that point yet, but I do think we're hovering dangerously close to it. And so I hope that we all are able to sort of take a moment and take a beat and remember that there is more that binds us and joins us than that which divides us and take the time to remember that and share that and communicate in a civil way that can hopefully elevate the tone of our public discourse.
The name of the book is On All Fronts, The Education of a Journalist. Clarissa, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Clarissa Ward is CNN's chief international correspondent and the author of a new memoir, On All Fronts, The Education of a Journalist. It's published by Penguin Random House. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.